August 26, 2020. It's the Watch from Pedro show.
Thank you.
Watt for Pedro show last Wednesday for August. Brother Matt, Love Grotto, quarantino mode. But I'm not totally man alone because of those engineers in Estonia with their Skype software invention. I got Damon Smith from St. Louis aboard. Welcome, Damon.
Yeah, man. Glad to be here. Glad to be on board.
Okay. We started the show off with John Coltrane doing Cherry Co. And after that, Damon Smith, Fire and Lichen. Damon, what's your earliest musical recollection, please?
Well, you know, I brought a bass home, an upright bass home in fourth grade for about a week. So that's my earliest of actually playing music.
Earliest musical.
It's probably, you know, my dad listening to, like, The Doors or something like that. You know, my dad's born in 53, and he was into all that kind of rock from that period. And it was probably something like The Doors, you know, and thinking about that lyric, Killers on the Road, Brain is Squirming Like a Toad, that kind of thing.
Damon, when you say that era, you don't mean 1953. You're probably talking about 1965, 66, 67.
Yeah, 65 until, you know, the middle 70s. You know, that's when my dad was really listening to a lot of that kind of stuff. And then my mom played classical guitar. So there would have been some of that. And then, you know, piano and things like that.
You mean there's a piano at the pad?
Yeah.
And where's this, Damon?
Well, this would be in Kennewick, Washington to start with. And then we ended up in Fremont, California, and Livermore, California. You know, right around, that's all around Oakland, San Francisco, those places.
Well, it's a little more east of there. In fact, it's closer to where the Rolling Stones tried to do their Altamont gig.
Absolutely. That's right outside of Livermore. And, you know, Kennewick was right outside. My dad was working on the nuclear reactors at Hanford. He's an electrician.
That's up in Washington.
Yeah, that's where I was. That's where I kind of grew up until 13, we end up in California.
But there's another nuke connect with Livermore because all the buttons.
Yep. You know,
the plutonium. Yeah.
Yeah, Lawrence Livermore Labs. A lot of my friends in high school and middle school, their parents worked there and stuff like that.
Well, probably your pop, because that's Hanford was another nuke thing.
He was mainly going into the city and doing, like, tech stuff by then, and going, like, the Silicon Valley and stuff like that. And Livermore was sort of one of the closest places he could buy a decent house. And so, that's what he was doing.
Wow, that's on the other side of the bay, though.
Yeah, you know, he'd do these long commutes. He's a real soldier.
You're talking about Sunnyvale. In fact, there's three big airship hangars there they built in the 30s.
I've never been to those.
Well, I don't think you really go to them, but you can drive. You can drive by them. They're so huge they didn't tear them down. I mean, you know, I'm talking not blimps, but airships, big metal.
Oh, right. Okay.
We had the Shenandoah and the Akron and one was called the Los Angeles. A lot of bad accidents, so we got out of that. And then the blimps came later, but they were more like a no rigid thing. But let's get to your music thing. So you grew up in a house where there's listeners and there's and there's players.
Yeah.
So why didn't you get on the guitar or the piano young?
Well, my dad kept telling me that I should. And then I said, well, I want a bass. And I was doing this freestyle BMX thing.
Yeah, but why did you want a bass?
This was before I'd heard you. You know what I was into then? In that period, like middle school on, I was really into Fear, GBH, those kind of bands, you know, and Fear, Black Flag. I was just starting to get Black Flag.
I'll tell you something about Fear. The bass player was Durf Scratch. I bought my first Fender P bass from Durf Scratch out of the recycler when Minuteman was first starting.
That's amazing.
And he had real heavy flats on it, maybe 120 E string.
Wow, like an upright bass.
Pert and air, I mean.
Yeah.
but it did pull up on the neck because there was so much tension. He had those, and he's got a guy who told me, if don't buy new ones, if they get kind of dead, boil them in water. I tried that once, and it didn't work. Sorry, I thought you said you played a stand-up when you were in the fourth grade.
Just for a week. and then I took it back. So it was a real fleeting thing. It was just 1 week, and then I didn't do it, and then I was doing this bicycle thing and into punk rock, you know, and kind of like we needed something when we were doing these bike tricks. We needed music that wasn't so harsh, but it was a complicated thing we were doing, so we liked complicated stuff. So a lot of Fire Hose, a lot of Meat Puppets. You know, this is like my later teens, you know, when we're really serious about that. My friend Mike Woods found that Sometimes EP, and we really loved it. And then we kind of went backwards, got the Minutemen, Meat Puppets, and all that. But, like, there was this period where, like, all the Fire Hose records were going hard tapes out of the boombox, right, at the parking lot. And, you know, Meat Puppets, Up on the Sun, those kind of records. And they were sort of just right for doing these things. And then my friend Mike and I, this is where I get into playing bass. My friend Mike and I went to San Jose State, and I forget who, I think it was one of Juliana Hatfield. She might have opened, then it was Fire Hose, then Primus at San Jose State. It was early 90s.
We played there, it was with Maceo Parker.
Oh, it wasn't Primus.
It was
okay.
Maceo Parker is what I remember.
Wow.
San Jose State, that's what I remember.
Yeah.
I played with Fire Hose with Primus at the Greek Theater.
But I remember those gigs. Yeah.
The other band was called, they were the Kemper Van Beethoven guys. But they
Cracker.
Were, yeah, they were later on, some of the guys.
But anyway, you know, you come out playing, and we weren't prepared
for...
Damon,
things get blurry, so don't worry about that so much. I'm interested about this bass in the fourth grade. What happened? Class, he said...
It was a string instrument class, and it had gut strings, right? Because this was the 70s still. Okay. And I liked it, but, you know, I'm carrying it home on the bus and everything. And then I think I just brought it back, and it didn't really take. It was weird, but that was the impulse.
Your,
you know, there was that impulse.
But your school had music class like that.
Yes.
A grade school.
Yeah, it was like a grade school in Washington State. This
yeah,
is
but
kind
that's,
of Washington.
That's not so common, you know?
That's no, incredible. Not even then. And it wasn't an orchestra, though. It was like a string quartet, but with bass.
Okay. And what about the first record that you bought with your own money?
I'll tell you exactly what it was. It was Kiss Alive.
And what was the first gig you went and saw?
The first gig that I went and saw that I can remember was... I'm trying to think about that. That I really saw, because, you know, we were living in Washington State. There wasn't anything going on there. I don't think I ever saw live music in that period. I wanted to go see Kiss when I was little, but it never happened. And it might have been, like, The Accused in San Francisco.
Okay.
It's one of those places that you would have played this club. It was a really well-known club. Bruce Conner took a lot of his photos there, and Flipper used to play there. And it was up kind of in North Beach. I mean, it's slipping my mind. But famous punk club. Not the Mab, but another one. And The Accused played there. And that might have been my first show that I ever went to.
And what about the thing where after school you want to... Well, you really don't make the bridge because you let that string bass alone.
Yeah.
So you never got into electric bass guitar?
Well, I did after I saw you at San Jose State because, you know, and it was a really interesting thing because I loved music. I mean, I was really into it. You know, I was really into your records. I was really into all these punk bands and stuff. And I was doing this bike thing, and I didn't really think that it was a thing that you should do, that I would do. I didn't think it was a thing for me. And then you came out that day with Fire Hose playing. And I already knew I liked your bass playing. I already knew I liked the bass. So I already knew, you know, Mike Watts, the bass player, these bass lines are great. I understood that much. But we didn't know how hardcore Fire Hose was.
But you're out of high school.
Yeah, like just 18 and a half
yeah,
or so,
but
right
what
about
you're telling
then.
Me is that in junior high and high school, you never had a band after school, like in the bedroom or the garage
no.
or the bass. You never did any of that.
None of that. No, I was just doing these bike tricks.
Oh, yeah, well, that's not music, but...
No.
I know you were doing
it.
Something. You were just doing bicycle, okay?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But you were probably going to some gigs. You said you, by this time, you're not in Washington. You're in California.
I'm in California, and I would just, you know, I was just obsessed with the bicycle thing and just records and tapes, you know, just tapes. And,
okay, but
and that,
no,
that was
no
the way I was hearing it.
Because I know out in the Livermore part, there was no gigs.
Now, there wasn't a lot I could get to. And that's when, in Livermore was when I went to see The Accused. And then I started going to the city to see some stuff when it would come around.
And then
when I ended up leaving home early, I left home at 18. And then I was still doing the bicycle thing and really doing that hardcore. But this was before the X Games, so there's no money in it or anything. And that's when I saw this fire hose gig. And then that's when everything changed. And I don't know, probably 2 weeks after that, I got a bass, and it was, of course, a P bass. It was a Red Squire.
You know, these days, there's a town there called Dublin.
Yep.
And it's a big strip mall, track home.
Yep. My dad lives next to it in Pleasanton, and one of my best friends, this artist, Daniel Healy, he's from Dublin, and I always make jokes to him about it.
It's way different than when you were a boy, right? I mean, geez,
way different.
It became like a burb for the city or something. Look, I want to play The Embers of the Year. Thank you.
treat us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Watt for Pedro show. Yeah, Damon Smith doing the Embers of the Year. Then R04, and I'm on there with bass and some voice. Konbawa, the real version out of Tokyo. Orin Ambrachi, Jim O'Rourke, and Few with Patient Soup. Just a sample, because it's a big piece. Tobacco from his upcoming album, Body Double. Minutemen Live in 1985, Indianapolis. Fuck, I can't remember the venue. But In Your Eyes. Haven't heard that in a while. You know, there's something off a three-way tie, which I don't really listen to. Television with Dick Hill, 1975, doing UFO, CBGBs. Pat Smear after that, Guitar Man for the Germs, from his second solo album, Ever Alone with Thee. Chris Chappelle's Distortion Pedal out of North Carolina with Factory Reset. And finally, Damon Smith, Broken Mirrors, Where the World Sees Itself Shattered. So, you're going into the city, you're seeing some hardcore?
Yeah, I'm seeing some like the guys that would form Rancid and stuff like that, you know, because they're, well, I think, around my age.
I think that was, and if I remember right, ska band named Operation Ivy.
Exactly. Yeah, those guys would be around. And then, you know, once I started playing, you know, because then I'm just like 18, 19.
Matt, a really good bass man. His name is
Matt. great bass player. I can't remember his name.
His first name is Matt.
Yeah.
And I think he lives in SoCal now. But that guy could, and I think he was in both bands. And he could.
Yes.
He can
beautiful
jam.
Bass
he can,
player.
Yeah, he can jam. He can jam. So, but I'm trying to get the listeners caught up here, Damon. So you're seeing gigs in the city, and you go and you buy a Fender.
I had a friend, and I knew she had one. And I'm working at a gas station, and it's long enough times, you know. So I embezzled the money. I'd like sold some stuff and didn't report it because I wanted to play bass so bad. And I bought it from her for $50 that night. I just made this decision. It was about 2 weeks after seeing you play. I was like, I gotta have a bass. And then I bought it from her, and then I went and got it, and I started playing on it.
Yeah, but what, then, Damon, what about an amp?
Then I got a PV amp, like, about 3 days later.
Yeah.
One of those, you know how it goes. Squire P bass PB amp, you know.
Well, I didn't have the Squire P bass, but first Minuteman amp was a PV400 with 215s, 300 watt.
Yeah, nice. I got a pretty nice PV later. The
I don't
rack
think
mount
it was
PV
that
with
nice, but it was, you know, what can you do, right there, Econo?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then I started going to see all kinds of stuff. You know, by that point I'd moved into Oakland, and I was going to Gilman Street all the time. You know, that's when I would start to see you more regularly. You know, I saw that one gig at San Jose State, and then I was still out in the suburbs a little bit and didn't get out as much. But then pretty much every time you came through with Firehose, the whole time Firehose was around, we were at the gig. If it was in the Bay Area or Sacramento, you know, we were there. And even after that, you know, I saw the Engine Room stuff at Bottom of the Hill and all that. And, you know, I ended up playing a lot of those places, Slim's and Bottom of the Hill. And I think Slim's is such a great club.
I think
it's sad that it closed.
Contemplating the Engine Room with Slim's, not Bottom of the Hill.
Right. And then I feel like there was something at Bottom of the Hill with Biza.
Well.
Does that seem right? And the drummer from the Engine Room. A trio of yours.
Well, Joe Biza was in the first three touring bands of Contemplating the Engine Room.
Okay.
The first tour is with Steve Hodges, then with Bob Lee. But look, I want this to be about you, not fucking me.
Yeah, but there's some interesting things about you that would
here's what I think would be more interesting, because I actually get invited by you without Firehose, or even without Contemplating the Engine Room. You asked me to come up and play with three of your buddies on
stand-up
bass.
Yeah, yeah, Bullfiddle. Okay. The bass quartet.
Okay, I think this is more important, Damon.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll tell you one of the heaviest things about that is, like, I thought, hey, I'll call you up and maybe you'll send us a piece of music to play. You know, and you say, well, I got lots of music, I'll come up there and play. And then what the heavy thing for me, being such a Minutemen fan, is the first time I heard a lot of those, the first time I heard any Minutemen songs live was playing them with you. And you can imagine the intensity of that for a young musician, you know, to play these songs.
Yeah, but they're a little different. Come on, there's no Georgie, there's no D Boone.
No, they're different, but it's like, you know, it's you know, and then later, you know, you're doing them with the Missing Men, which was really cool. But that was such a weird project to do. You know, and I didn't know.
Well, with the Missing Men, they were actually for the encore
for the
third opera, and I wanted to show people the connection between the parts of the third opera and stuff I had written for the Minutemen. But again, we're talking about me. Look, this is not you, Damon.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but
So the heavy thing that also.
Yeah, but
these
people weren't there, so let's explain to them.
So I had a bass quartet with my three of my friends, Lincoln Smith, Morgan Guberman, and George Kramoski. And we were trying to get pieces from people. We were trying to get something from Chadbourne. We had recorded something at Chadbourne's, and we were trying to get something from Elliot Sharp, and then we asked Mike Watt. Watt says, I'll come up and play with you. So I get a gig for us, and there's another heavy component where the gig had a little bit of money, and I asked you if we could spend half of it on Turetsky, Bertram Turetsky, the greatest avant-garde classical double bass soloist. And you were happy to do that. You said, oh, that sounds great. You know.
Well, actually, it was three gigs.
Yeah, we did one in Oakland, and then I think a rehearsal.
One was at a club in the city called DNA.
DNA, yeah, yeah.
And then there was a coffee shop in East Bay.
That's right.
And then, actually, it was first 2 days of just wailing on it with Prack.
Yeah.
And it was very sweaty.
Yes, my apartment had no AC.
That's all right. What I liked was nobody gave up. Everybody stuck to it and kept going and kept the focus, and we ended up doing the gigs, and I got to meet Bertram Turetsky and improvise with him. Incredible. That was at the DNA Lounge.
Yeah. And you would say, with your bows, Eiler.
Yeah.
This is great.
The Arco.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, even though I'm bass, I'm not really from the stand-up world so much, you know, and so there was a lot to learn. I went and got one and tried to learn it, but man, is it tough. But that was a trippy gig, people. It was four stand-up basses and one on electric bass. And then we got
you to... You did a couple of solos, too.
Well, we got to also accompany Mr. Turetsky on it, some improvisation.
Yeah. Yeah, and you did a couple of solo pieces for an encore from Mr. Machinery Operator all by yourself. The one that Pettibone wrote the lyrics to.
Well, what that was stuff that I had played.
Yeah, it was
for
great.
The last song of that tour I did with Dave Grohl, Ed Vedder, and Pat Smear. I would come out.
I saw
and do, it was called Powerful Hankering, a song I wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, it's some dose. Music, and then I put it to Raymond's words for the last Fire Hose album. But again, we're talking about me, David.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about the way that you play the bass guitar,
David, you got to save it because we're at the end of the first hour.
Okay.
Of the August 26, 2020 edition, the Watt from Pedro Show with a special guest, Damon Smith. Hold tight for hour two. August 26, 2020. It's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
your message. You can bounce it off the moon, Lord, Lord.
One, secondhand gloves. Two, a king drinking pear juice trapped in a glass jar. Three, wet hair and wet fur. Four, velvet spurs. Five, directions to the other world.
Thank you. memories going through my head, accompanied by tears and sighs. I'm laying here on my lonely bed, reading from my book of lies. Read all your ruthless words through these tears in my eyes. Calculated and truthless words, they're written down here in my book of lies. Oh, how you promised, said you loved me right from the start. Every promise you made was a promise broken, and every broken promise broke my heart. Now as I read here what you said to me, honey, I'm gonna love you till the sun don't rise. Like all weepers, I weep alone, reading from my book of lies. Oh, you promised and promised, said you loved me right from the start, and every promise made was a promise broken, and every broken promise broke my heart. Now, as I read it, what you said to me, baby, I'll love you till the sun don't rise. Like all weepers, I weep alone, reading from my book of lies. Like all weepers, alone, reading from my book of
Watch for Pedro show. We start off the second hour. Damon Smith, The Race and Landscape. Sam Bennett after that, Tokyo, originally Birmingham. Same town, Sun Ra, right? Birmingham,
yeah.
Sonny Blount. You know, his bass man ended up writing a lot of songs later on.
Well, you know, I think a lot of those Sun Ra songs consisted of Sun Ra pointing at Ronnie Blakens, because that was, for me, the best bass man of his.
Well, he's got credit for a song I covered last year with Tar Baby's Bucky Pope called Tiny Pyramids, and he's got the song credit.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
Great bass player.
Sam Bennett. Yeah, and a stand-up guy, too. And he did a lot of Arco.
Yeah, yeah. There's a reissue of Heliocentric Worlds where you can hear him really well. And actually, I think if you could hear him this well before, it's a Swiss company, Haddart, doing these reissues. And I think he would have been one of the most famous bass players even more so, because when you hear what he's doing, he's an incredible technical bass player. And yeah, so creative.
But he also laid the foundation for a lot of Sun Ra's tunes in the 60s and 70s. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's a Chicago guy. My friend, drummer that I played with a lot, Alvin Fielder, who was in Sun Ra's band in the 50s, played with him a lot and used to talk about him. But lovely bass player.
There's a great book, John Zved, Bass is the Place. And it goes back all the way where he goes from Bama up to Chicago, and, you know, he's playing R&B clubs. Fletcher Henderson, that's who's a big inspiration for him.
Yeah.
Anyway, Sam Bennett after that with Bless Your Pretty Bones. Ma She Win, this is something in the city. She read some poems. But she was in SoCal in the early 80s, punk scene, South Bay. Storage Unit 202. His name is Alive, Water and Birds, but I think something came out today by him. Or it got remixed by some people in D.C. or something. I'll find out later, people. Guided by Voices, Bob Pollard, End It With Light. Kim Salmon, Spencer P. Jones. We lost Brother Spencer P. Jones to cancer last year. Very sad. Great cat. I got to meet him with, he was playing with Beast of Bourbon. Scorched Earth Pearl. And Betty LeVette, Book of Lies. The Verve people sent me that. And then finally, From Green to Yellow, Damon Smith. So this gig, I know, okay, you were just looking for music. Then I came up and played, spent some days with you guys, and we put together a gig and played some gigs. But you say it was a big deal in your music thing?
Yeah, to be able to, you know, to be able to get to interface with that music that was so important to me, you know, and to also go to the source of what made me want to play music in the first place. You know, you can't imagine. I mean, you can probably imagine what that's like having played with Joey Bouchard now, you know, and stuff like that. But Joey Bouchard. Yeah. So it's kind of like that for me. You know, it was like this heavy thing, and then it was an interesting thing because it put me at a crossroads. What do I do next?
You know, me and Joe. But when I played with Joe, it was never two basses. Like in the studio, I remember he played piano. So I never got to do a two-bass thing with it, unfortunately. His brother Albert, a lot of times him on the drums. But I never got to do the two-bass, because I learned a lot of bass things, bass guitar stuff, from probably Joe Bouchard and Dennis Dunaway were the biggest U.S. influences on me as far as rock and roll bass. Then the other U.S. influences, James Jamerson and who's the thumb guy in Sly's band?
Larry Graham.
Larry Graham. Those are big influences. You just recently gave me this piece of music from Ben Patterson, The Variation for Double Bass, 1961.
Yeah.
Ah! As always, I write the postcard to Bertram Turetsky. Thanks for everything you've done for the base. Damon, best Damon, post it through the F-hole.
Thank you. Thank you. Simple truth. I bought a dollar and a half's worth of small red potatoes, took them home, boiled them in their jackets, and ate them for dinner with a little butter and salt. Then I walked through the dried fields on the edge of town. In middle June, the light hung on in the dark furrows at my feet. And in the mountain oaks overhead, the birds were gathering for the night, the jays and mockers squawking back and forth, the finches still darting into the dusty light. The woman who sold me the potatoes was from Poland. She was someone out of my childhood, in a pink spangled sweater and sunglasses, praising the perfection of all her fruits and vegetables at the roadside stand, and urging me to taste even the pale, raw sweet corn trucked all the way, she swore, from New Jersey. Eat, eat, she said. Even if you don't, I'll say you did. Some things you know all your life. They're so simple and true, they must be said without elegance, meter, and rhyme. They must be laid on the table, beside the salt shaker, the glass of water, the absence of light gathering in the shadows of picture frames. They must be naked and alone. They must stand for themselves. My friend Henry and I arrived at this together in 1965, before I went away, before he began to kill himself, and the two of us to betray our love. Can you taste what I'm saying? It is onions or potatoes, a pinch of simple salt, the wealth of melting butter. It is obvious. It stays in the back of your throat like a truth you never uttered, because the time was always wrong. It stays there for the rest of your life, unspoken, made of that dirt we call earth, the metal we call salt, in a form we have no words for, and you live on it.
Watch for Pedro show. You just heard Damon Smith with Heat Rest. Before that was Benjamin Boone and Philip Levine doing The Simple Truth. Redneck Manifesto ahead of that. Rubber Up. Ghost in front of that. That's a band from the city. Chrome. No. Chrome is the band. Helios Creed. Ghost is a tune. Flying Vipers before that. Brand new. Cloud Kill. There's some reggae bass there. Peter Lochner from the old Cleveland scene. Doing Jonathan Richman, huh? Pablo Picasso. And then we started all off with something Damon gave me. I want you guys to hear about this because the world of improvised music is kind of trippy because people actually cover improvised pieces and there's actually instructions, people. Let them know, Damon.
Well, so Benjamin Patterson was an African-American classical bass player in the 50s and 60s, and he wasn't allowed to do that in America because you couldn't do that here. So he ended up in Canada. Long story short, he makes a connection with Stockhausen to do electronic music in Cologne. He gets there. Stockhausen's a dick. And that same night, he goes and meets John Cage and David Tudor, and he's on the founding. He ends up as a founder of the Fluxus movement. The most famous person from that is Yoko Ono, that people know. And it was a lot of poets and artists and musicians trying to find a common ground and dissolve things. And so Ben made this monumental bass piece, and it's 4 pages of very specific instructions. You know, you got to stick a balloon inside the bass with a surgical tube and blow it up and have that inflate a balloon. And then have that play a slide whistle. So that thing, the slide whistle plays that. You got to eat at the end of it. You know, you got to try to tune the bass with bird calls. And there's a lot of things that are fairly absurdist. And the way I do it, I try to do it deadpan. But then this recording, so the piece is about half visual, but Ben did it as an audio-only piece. And when I did it as an audio-only piece, I realize there's no silent section, so I'm trying to push forward all the sounds of each section that they make. One of them, you know, you got to put a map on the floor, put the end pin of the bass in the city you're playing in, and circle it. And I've got it. It's coming out as a lathe cut limited edition, and should be out in the middle of September. But the digital version's up at my Bandcamp now. But yeah, so that's it. I got to meet Ben. He had a big show in Houston. He died. He was in his 80s. But I got to meet him, and we got to talk about the bass and mainly classical bass. And we went out to eat and stuff like that. And he was a great guy.
But I don't know if you would call that classical bass.
Well, you know, not really. But there's things where he says play Webern. And then there was an earlier version that actually had some classical lines in it. But I do the one that he did. This the version from the end of his life. He had some orchestral bits in there in the earlier parts.
No, why I bring that up, Damon?
Yeah,
it's because bass in my mind, it's almost like the word that's pronounced the same but spelled with an E in the end.
Yeah,
almost like a foundation. Yeah, but you pursued bass in a direction where it is not the foundation; it's man alone.
Yeah, The thing is, I'm 47 and I've been doing the improvised music for like 25 years, and I never really made a solo record like that one that I just sent you. Cause I do like playing, I like to listen to solo bass a lot, and I like doing the gigs sometimes, but mainly I like to play with people. Kind of like what you're saying, the glue and all that. And, you know, I like to do it with the bass as an equal partner, but I still like that foundational idea. I just like redefining what the foundation could be.
Okay, because foundation with other guys, not man alone, ensemble.
Yeah, yeah.
It probably requires some kind of repetition.
Well, some ways I kind of think about it as, you know, you have the string bass, the bow and everything, right? And in some ways I think about it as you've got a whole string section right there. So if you're doing stuff that's not in the low end, it's still sort of like, you could do something that would maybe be like the violins playing a part that's not a solo part, right? And then the low end comes in and there's drama. So I like to kind of think about it in some ways that way, that you've got this whole orchestra right there. And there's this great trumpet player, Bill Dixon, and he was a guy who would use 2 basses and sometimes 3. For his first record, Intents and Purposes, has Jimmy Garrison and Reggie Workman on it. But he used to say that each person is their own orchestra.
People, those are the 2 bass players that work with John Coltrane. But here's what I'm saying, Damon. I mean, if you really want an instrument with a big spread, cello. And talk about drama that's tuned in fifths, so the jumps are bigger.
Yeah.
But what I was saying is, when I hear you in an ensemble, you don't do repetition.
Not very much, though.
Yeah. That's what I should have said more than just Man Alone. It's like, there's nothing wrong with it, and it's not anti-bass. It's just another way of doing it. And what I'm asking you is, what kind of like pushed you that way?
I think, in a lot of ways, it was the way that your music had so many color changes in it as far as bass guitar goes. Like, I don't even know if there's a bass guitar player besides guys like Michael Manring and Victor Wooten who put more colors in their line. And so it was sort of pursuing that and then wanting it not to ever end. So it just sort of keep going. It keeps going from there, like one thing to the next. And the other thing is, in improvised music, depending on who you're playing with, let's say you're playing with a jazz guy, if you give them too much repetition, they'll get stale. So some of it comes from that Charles Mingus stuff, you know, where he's playing under a soloist and him and Danny Richmond will just double the time.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways it's a version of that. Like, you can either lay it down for someone or you can pull the rug out, you know. And then later on, I got a lot more into walking bass, you know, when I started to play with these great drummers. You know, because you know how the thing I call a bass player dumb luck, where you just end up on stage with somebody who you never thought you'd play with. You know, and then when I started to get with these great drummers, I would do a little more repetition and lay into the bass part so much because it feels so good with them. You know, this guy Alvin Fielder, who I played with quite a bit, who Dave Dove, who was on your show, must have talked about. He was in Sun Ra's band in the 50s.
Houston guy who plays trombone.
Yeah.
Bass clef. Look, Damon, well, I also think there was a function... why that walking happened because of the way they used the kick drum. But we ran out of time. It's the second hour, August 26th,
all right,
2020 edition. Wap Peter Show, special guest Damon Smith. Hold tight for hour three. August 26th, 2020, it's the third hour. Wap for Peter Show. Watch for Pedro show. We start off the third hour with Thirst Wakes and Builds, Damon Smith, and Crane with Second Thoughts, Ned Collette and Wirewalker with At the Piano, Moloman out of Baltimore with Imperial Chemicals, Punk is a Doornail with Nacho Burger, and finally Two Hands, something live from Damon Smith. Yeah, because, you know, drummers used kick drum for bombs. They didn't use it. I think it's Earl Palmer with Little Richard, because he wasn't carrying a bass man, that he comes up with that steady kick drum thing. So I think it was, for one thing, it was hard to record. You kind of referred to this. It's hard to record stand-up basses in the old days.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe even nowadays, even though we got contact pickups and stuff.
Even still, you just want to point a mic at the thing, you know, and get some good separation. You know, that's always the best way. I did one album where I ran my pickup through with, it's an album called, I think you have it, called Astral Plane Crash, that Henry Kaiser probably gave you, that we did with Weasel and the great drummer Bob Moses, who was on that Pat Metheny record with Jocko, Bright Size Life. And so it was two drummers, and I just thought, okay, we'll do the pickup for this one and deal with it like the 70s, you know. But usually I just put a mic in front of it, get a little bit of baffling, and it comes out okay. With today's technology, you know, they can get it recorded pretty well. Yeah. But, you know, this kick drum thing is interesting, because that drummer Alvin that I was playing with, we were at a gig in Austin once, and we're playing with a Norwegian saxophone player, and we're doing the sound check, and he doesn't have a kick drum pedal, right? And we're doing it, and everything sounds good, and then somebody brings in the kick drum pedal, and the way he played the kick drum pedal, once he starts getting it in there, he made the bass louder, and the whole group opened up instead of burying stuff. Those old guys knew how to feather the bass drum in this way that opened up the music in a very special way.
Yeah, but and I mean, it was another way of using it. It was just completely different. And also, you know, we're talking about a time when piano and guitar were considered rhythm section.
Yeah.
Everybody except the fucking horns and the strings was rhythm section.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just a whole other way. And it's interesting, guys like you who play stand-up, and you kind of bring some of that old days into a world where we know other things that they didn't know then. But you still explore. Even though you're using this traditional, actually, it's a fucking violin that's all steroided up without a chin part.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Well, I think they did that to keep the timbre the same.
Yeah.
Right? They did it with saxophone. They did it with all kinds of instruments. So the timbre would kind of stay the same. You just made them smaller or bigger. God, yeah. I saw this one fucking really contrabass saxophone. You got to get on a fucking ladder to play.
Yeah, Vinny, you played with Vinny. You must play Vinny Goli a bunch of times, right?
Yeah, but he never played that. He was playing soprano. But I know the Violent Femmes' brother Steve McKay told me about them using.
He's got what is it? He's got the Tubax. That's this kind of, it's a contrabass saxophone, but it's all twisted up so it's smaller and he can handle it. Vinny has everything. He's a great, great musician.
Yep. I met him through Miles Klein.
Yeah, did you ever see like John Carter or Horace Tapscott or those guys coming up? I've always wanted to ask you that.
When I saw Horace Tapscott, his bass player was Roberto Miranda.
Great bass player, man.
Beautiful, really, really intense. And then a couple times, like Watts Festivals, things me and Raymond Pettibone would go to, he had three bass players, Roberto one of them.
Well, you know who played tuba for him was Red Callender, who was Mingus's bass teacher.
Well, yeah, at high school, right, yeah.
Yeah, great LA bass player.
Right, tuba. I saw Red, but he was so old by this time, he only played a song and he had his students playing. But Raymond knew about all this shit, and he would take me to see all these guys. You know, I was very, very lucky that way. But Roberto Miranda, a very physical player, really... interesting guy with Horace, the giant has a reason, and beautiful shit. Here I want to play From Yellow to Red. Thank you.
So as you can tell, we're improvising, so we're making stuff up on the moment. Help me out over here.
That's what we're doing.
Yeah. So. Uno más? You guys game for another one?
No, I'm not afraid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter show last music for this edition from Yellow to Red from Damon Smith. Piece number 4. This is live October 2nd, 2008. Motoka Honda, Joe Berardi, Emily Hay, all improvised. And finally, Slick Insides, Bertram Tereski and Damon Smith.
Well, yeah, so, you know, after that stuff we did, I ended up studying with Bertram on and off. You know, whenever I could get down there, his son lived up in the Bay Area and he would come up and I'd take lessons from him. And I became friends with him, and then one day we were on the phone, and one of us, I can't remember if it was me or him, said we should make a duo, and then we're like, oh yeah, you know, and I got the studio time and everything, and then like 3 days later, I was like, holy shit, I gotta make this duo with Tereski, I better, you know, because I wasn't intimidated at first, because he's such a nice guy, but then once it hit me, that was a really big thing to be able to do.
Yeah, well, the reason I got it is because you floated to me.
and the titles are from a poet that you might know, Paul Ceylon, very Econo poet, you know, 3 or 4 lines like Minutemen songs. And he made up these words, these compound words, and those are the English translations of them.
Right. So what you like to do is set up events and see what happens.
Yeah, and some ways of working I have that are a little bit different. Sometimes I'll have people that I, like somebody in the town that I live in, like in Houston, I was playing a lot with this guitar player, Sandy Ewan, or David Dove, and so we'd do a gig and it'd be them plus the new person. Or like Weasel Walter and I have done, you know, 50 projects together. So you got a couple known quantities and then a new one. One of the reasons I started doing improvised music, and this is something that you could relate to, I was listening to a record, and I won't say who because the people are still alive, but the bass player I ended up studying with later, and the bass part was just so stupid. And I had this idea of the saxophone player walking over to the bass part with bass player with this piece of music in his hand that wasn't very good. And then the whole thing about improvising for me in a lot of ways is that I try to – my idea is that I don't want to play with someone that I feel I need to play what to do. You know, if I don't need to tell them what to play. Like if I get a trombone player, they're going to handle the trombone part and they're going to play it better than anything I could come up with. And like on that solo record that you've been playing, like those are sort of my compositions. And they're not the same every time, but there's a lot of that material that I bring out. And then each time I bring it to a new person, they have something different to say with it. And it's kind of a philosophy like that to just kind of see what the people bring to the thing instead of bossing them around, you know. And you can imagine, you know, there's so many bass parts that aren't very good, you know, like when you were saying how these early bass players were the ones that you could hear. You know, that's who you were into, you know.
Well, you know, to me, it's a good bass part if the song works.
Yeah.
I really believe you gotta, like, need some kind of focus. Well, what you're saying is great, though. You don't want all the communication before. You want the communication while you guys are playing.
Yeah. Well, and I think you can make a good, like in this case, it was one of those 80s jazz things where the bass player just repeats the thing over and over, and they play a tricky head, and somebody just solos on it forever and nothing. And yeah, I think you can make great repeating bass lines. I mean, you've got a million of them. There's people like the bass player, Ronnie Boykins, that we're talking about. I mean, he had the best repeating bass lines of anybody. So it's not that I'm against that. It's just that I wanted the bass to have its own voice you know, always. And that comes from you. And then the next person that really blew me away was the German bass player, Peter Kowald. And I had this record of his where he's doing duos with a bunch of people, and they're short pieces, not Minutemen short, but 3 or 4 minutes. And his whole thing was that the bass would be an equal partner in the thing. But he was also into these real short pieces when he made records. And coming from the Minutemen as my favorite thing to listen to at that period, that was real easy for me to grasp onto. You know, these short pieces, and he'd have kind of a couple ideas in it, and they'd be improvised with a trio or something like that. And then that kind of stuck with me. And then to just try to keep the bass as an equal voice in the group is a thing. But it's not for everybody. You know, I mean, we need other people to do more traditional bass. And I actually like to teach that stuff, and I love, you know, figuring out what a bass line's doing. And when I play jazz, I like to just stick to quarter notes.
What about where it dominates? Because you haven't brought up the big dominate genre, which is what? Reggae.
Yeah.
What's your take on Family Man?
What do you mean? The reggae record or the Black Flag record?
No, Family Man was Bob Marley.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I never got too into Bob Marley. I you know, the only thing that I ever got into was and this is just going to sound dumb, but the only reggae I ever really loved, is the Sly and Robbie tracks where it's just them. Well, and I like that abstraction of the way they're putting those. There's some repeating bass lines, you know, where he's putting those notes in the weirdest places, but there's only two notes.
Yeah, his last name was Barrett, Family Man Barrett, you know, obviously okay. A nickname. But a lot of things they also switch up is the drums to fit those bass lines. Like, they'll put the kick on the twos.
Yeah. Yeah, that's okay. Intense.
And that's something I learned. To get, like you said, you wanted bass to have room. One of these ways of doing it is organizing the tunes, because the closest note to us is actually the kick drum. It looks like a guitar, or yours looks like a violin, but they're actually like a weird kind of drum.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And the jazz thing, in a lot of ways, you know, the early jazz thing, the bass player's the drum, you know, Pops Foster and those guys. They're doing basically the drum part, and the drummers are doing more like a bell and cymbal part.
We were talking about a stand-up and a man alone on the bass, like Bill Black with Elvis, Scotty Moore. We were actually talking about Earl Palmer having to make up for not carrying a bass, but they didn't carry a drummer. And this is maybe where, you know, who's Sly's guy again?
Oh, Larry Graham. Yeah, well, he was playing Larry with his Graham, mom, and there was no drummer. Yeah.
Well, what I'm saying is, yeah, with the rockabilly, when they would slap against the neck. Sorry for my fucking memory being bad, Damon. Sorry. But you know
that
what I mean?
That was based on a swing pattern, right? That was based on when you learn how to do it. Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Swing drums, brushes on the snare drum.
But I think what we're really talking about is, like, all this technique stuff, they're means to an end. You know what I'm saying? They're all things to serve the tune, to get the band cooking.
Absolutely. And I think that when you hear me playing with a group, I am still trying to push the band, right? That is kind of the thing that I like to do. And that's why my music's still sort of related to jazz, even as weird as it gets. Like, I really like playing with a great drummer and getting in there and still pushing the group. You know, and that idea, that I think comes from Mingus. And it also comes from, you know, the Minutemen philosophy of each person being their own sovereign country. You know, I love that so much.
You brought up Charlie Mingus.
Yes.
I don't think he ever composed on the bass. I think he always used piano.
Yeah. Well, he studied with Art Tatum on piano, so he would just figure it out on piano.
I think his first tune was Mingus Fingers.
Yeah.
If you've read Beneath the Underdog, good book.
Great, incredible book, man. I love that. You know, I met Buddy Collette, you know, and I'm just thinking, this is the guy that taught, this guy's dad taught Mingus all about sex and everything. It was kind of funny to think about
one of the teachers. Mingus he was here to learn.
And maybe, he was here to learn.
And maybe some of that stuff in the book ain't all factual.
No, it probably is. It's got
but it's a great book. I recommend it to everyone. It's beautiful.
Everyone, yeah. The other one that's good is Art Pepper's Straight Life. That's the other good one.
That one bummed me out.
Yeah, it's a bummer, but it's also...
It bummed me out. I thought the one that Quincy Troop did on Miles... It's kind of trippy.
I just saw Quincy Troop's St. Louis guy. I just saw him read. I was supposed to do a gig with him years ago, and it never happened, but he was a beautiful, he's a beautiful writer, beautiful poet.
Well, read the Miles book. All right. And Hampton Hawes had a trippy book. There's something about that Street Time. He wrote that with his wife, and he seemed kind of a little bitter. I don't like what he said about John Coltrane trying to blow his brains out to keep up with young people. I think John Coltrane knew he was running out of time.
It seems like it because he's so productive at the end, you know. I mean, but I don't think Coltrane needed to keep up with anybody. I mean,
I know. Well, that, I'm giving you an example why that Straight Time book kind of bummed me out. He seems,
yeah.
You know, he spent more time in jail than out almost.
Yeah, great player though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, get this. He's from Pedro.
Oh wow!
He was a kid. His daddy was a merchant marine. He didn't spend much time here, but he's Pedro. Look, where can people find you on the internet, Damon?
Well, you know, my record label's website, balancepointacoustics.com, and balancepointacoustics at bandcamp.com or bandcamp.balancepointacoustics.com. I'm easy to find on the internet. I'm all over it. But, man, can I ask you one more thing before we go?
Yeah.
Can you just talk a little bit about those films with Raymond? Because, you know, Sir Drone, that's a whole other set of influences for me in my life. I mean, that's a, you know, Mike Kelly.
Drone basically is about making a band in the early days of the punk movement.
Yeah, it's an incredible film. And I bought the VHS from Raymond back when.
And if you were there, you don't have to really explain it because Raymond put in that script all the kind of stuff that was insane about those days.
Yeah, that's a great film, man.
So if you want to know my opinion on Mike Kelly, very sad. Also, the guy who played Scooter, Richie Lee, you know.
Scooter, right? Yeah, yeah.
He lost both those guys in real life, so very sad.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. My friend and I were going to go to a Mike Kelly show in New York at the Gagosian, the big piece he did, you know, Day Is Done, and I didn't know his artwork very well, and I said to my friend, hey, let's go see Jinx's show, and then it was unbelievable, and then I got into his work in a really big way, but yeah, that film was a big impact on me, you know. It's funny, but it's also, there's a lot of truth in it, too, so it's a great film.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of truth. That's the way Raymond is, you know. He's, black humor.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that on a Blue Oyster Cult. Their second album had that on a sticker, so I asked my ma, what does black humor mean? She said, Michael Watt, I want you to read Joe Heller's Catch 22.
Perfect.
It's been a big honor to have you on the show, Damon.
Honor to be here.
I know you do a lot of recordings, but the next record, like this one, was a big deal for you because it had a lot of your own compositions. But
yeah.
The next one you put out, would you come on the show and can we talk about it?
Yeah, for sure. Because I got a couple of them coming. I got something with Weasel Walter and Sandy Ewan in the fall and a bunch of other stuff.
Because there's, things I'd like to explore with you. Thank you so much. People, it's been the August 26, 2020 edition of the Watt Pedro Show. Keep your powder dry.